Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu, as usual, I hope, with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have some serious matters to discuss.
We do.
Yes, and we're going to start with the absolutely amazing book put out by Barry Esterbrook.
Who writes amazing books.
He does write amazing books. And on the jacket statement, Ruth Reichel says, you read this book and you'll never look at a pork chop the same again.
The interesting part about it is he does.
He does. You know. We actually did it once.
But he explains why. This is a book that comes in the category, I think, important.
I last talked to Barry Esterbrook when he had this wonderful book called Tomato Land, which is, I think of it as much lighter than this one. I'm sure you probably do too after doing the research on this latest book, Barry, called Pig Tales, T-A-L-E-S, An Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. I'll tell you, I read it cover to cover, and I really was reluctant to read it while I was eating. It seems to me that there's a darkness to this book that, although I knew that factory industrial farming was wicked and gross, you have a knack for presenting details that totally threw me for a loop, and I was compelled to read the whole thing, even though I was wondering how you could even stand researching it.
Well, you're exactly right. I think, you know, the take-home message that I got after 2 years among the pigs was that pork can be the worst possible meat to eat from any perspective, from environmental perspective, from the perspective of animal welfare, even from the perspective of human health and taste. Or it can be the very best, and it just all depends on how the pigs that you eat are raised. So you're right, much of the book is very dark. But the good news is, I think the book does have a happy ending, because
yeah,
the good news is that people are now beginning to raise pork again in a manner that is so much preferable to the industrial model. And that's gone from being something you almost couldn't find 5 or 10 years ago to something that's getting fairly easy to find.
What was it that drew you to this issue in the first place, Barry? Was there a singular incident before you decided? I mean, you committed 2 years to doing this.
What led me writing about pork was a pork chop.
Okay.
Someone gave me this pork chop, and I grilled it up outside, brought it in, and started to eat it, and it was transformative. It was the best pork. I couldn't believe at first that it was pork. So rich and reddish, not pink or pale pink. It was more red. It was deliciously fatty in the way of a well-marbled steak. And the taste was just rich and wonderful. I couldn't believe it was a pork chop. And I found out that, in fact, it had come from an old heritage breed of pig, and it had been raised on pasture its entire life. Unfortunately, most 97% of the pork raised in this country lives just the opposite. They live in cramped, crowded buildings. They never walk on the earth or see the light of day. And they all come from these cookie-cutter pig breeds that are designed primarily to grow fast, not to give good-tasting meat.
Now, kind of must have known what you were going to get into when you started researching this, because the sins of factory farming are well known to any of us who pay attention to this.
Well, I certainly had an idea, of course, what I was getting into. I had no idea the extent of it. I guess to begin with, right off the bat, like most people, I'd heard that pigs were smart,
right,
and sensitive. But I had no idea of just how intelligent a pig was, and how sensitive, and how putting an animal of this nature into a vast barn with thousands of other animals and depriving it of any stimulation, how that can affect an intelligent animal.
Right. You say that pig has the intelligence of a 3-year-old human child.
Yeah, well, that's not me saying that. That's a prominent professor at Cambridge University in England saying that. And, in fact, in this country, university researchers have trained pigs to operate computer games.
You said train, but in your book, you differentiate between training, like as in training animals, and teaching. And I wanted to know how you knew that the pigs that you were working with, or the researchers were working with, actually, they knew the difference, that they were actually teaching as opposed to training.
When you teach somebody something, you're actually teaching them an underlying concept. You teach a kid that 2 + 2 = 4, and then eventually the child, knowing that that's how the concept works, will be able to figure out on her own that 4 + 4 = 8 without you rotely, you know, because the child has figured out how the concept works. So pigs do the same thing. In the case of the computer game, there's nothing in a pig's natural world which resembles that. In that case, the pigs nuzzled a joystick to move a cursor toward a target. And if they hit the target, a machine would spit an M&M out. Well, in the real world, a pig plants its nose in the ground, and if there's an acorn there, it's right there. There's nothing that should suggest to the pig that a machine that's displaced from where they're actually rooting or working would give them something. And once they learn to hit a target somewhere on the screen, the researchers could move it anywhere. They could make it very tiny. They could do anything like that, and the pig knew that what I must do is move this cursor to hit that target. So it had learned the underlying principle and could apply it to different situations.
Now, were you surprised exactly how bad, really bad? I mean, it's disgusting what I'm reading in your book about how pigs are treated.
I didn't. You know, I did go to visit one major industrial pig farm. I spent an entire day there with 100, and this guy raises 150,000 pigs a year, if you can believe that, on one farm. And it was actually, he's considered a very good industrial pig farmer. So I didn't see the horrors that people may be familiar with from films like the ones that PETA gets. But I couldn't get over the fact that even in this sort of ideal industrial environment, the mother pigs, the sows, lived their entire lives in little metal crates that weren't even big enough to contain them. Their hips and their shoulders would be pressed against the sides of the gates, kind of like fat people in the middle seat of an airplane. There wasn't enough room, and they lived their whole life that way. They couldn't turn around. Their feces were building up. And you look at a barn where there are over 1,000 of these sows, and it just becomes overwhelming. And the growing pigs themselves, when they're little, they have some room to scamper around in their pens. But as they get bigger, the pens are sort of back, solid pig backs. There's no floor showing through. The air that they breathe, it not only smells awful, it's poisonous. It's full of ammonia, full of hydrogen sulfide. And these are poisonous gases. They're not just bad smells. And these animals breathe that air 24/7 for their entire lives.
You know, I think that of all the horrors that you describe in this book, I think aside from the animal welfare aspect of it, I was most horrified about the effects of this low dose antibiotic prophylactic stuff and what it does for building superbugs. Horrified me.
Really horrifying, because it's the use of antibiotics, constant use of small doses of antibiotics in agriculture, is contributing to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that you just can't cure. There's 23,000 deaths a year in the United States from these new bacteria, and a lot of them evolve on large agricultural operations, such as constant low doses. And once those bugs evolved, they can travel anywhere. They can travel on the wind. They can travel on the meat. Workers pick them up and travel. So they're not, you don't have to live anywhere near a pig farm to be affected by these diseases. I interviewed a woman who lived in downtown Chicago whose toddler son got a virulent, resistant infection and died. He'd never been near a farm. So it can affect all of us.
Now, I moved on beyond the conditions for the pigs are pretty bad, but the conditions for the neighbors, the human neighbors of the pig farm, was the thing that I found to be really alarming, and I wondered how this could legally be allowed to happen.
Well, throughout the country, most laws controlling agricultural activities were written during an era farms were small, when what you might catch coming off a farm would be just a slight whiff of manure. And to a small farm, that manure is not a pollutant, it's a valuable fertilizer.
Yeah.
So it's reused, it's recycled. This is an entirely different thing. A factory farm full of pigs, average-sized factory farm full of pigs, produces as much manure as an average small city.
Yeah, you said that.
And here you are, you know, if you have a small city, or any size city, we're required to treat our sewage and return the, you know, clean it. Well, you can have a farm producing the same amount of raw sewage from pigs, and they can just spray it on the land. It would be like your hometown, just instead of treating its sewage, if it just had big sprayers and blasted it all around in the air and on the land. They're exempt because from, you know, what we'd think of normal pollution laws, because they're judged under these old conditions, these right to farm issues and things like that, which applied to farms that were not industrial scale.
They've had episodes, however, where runoff from pig farms have affected the human food supply, and you'd think that would prompt them to do something. And this wasn't in Iowa, it was someplace on the East Coast.
Well, the biggest problem, I mean, they have huge problems with water quality in Iowa because of agricultural operations. In fact, the city of Des Moines is currently suing some counties in hog-raising areas of Iowa because of the pollution that's flowing into the rivers that form the water supply for Des Moines. But probably the worst area is in the Low Country in North Carolina, where they have a huge concentration of large hog farms. In an area where the population is predominantly poor and African American. And in those cases, people report going out in their yards and thinking it's raining, only to realize that it's not rain that's coming down, it's pig manure. They have many studies done showing that, you know, these gases, again, as I said, they're not just a whiff of manure, they're poisonous gases, drive up people's blood pressure. In an area that's already quite prone to strokes and other diseases related to blood pressure, so you know these are the sort of the costs of industrial farming that are not borne by the farmer.
Now you found a wonderful model of pig farming in Denmark of all places.
Well, what most people probably don't realize is that pig farming in Denmark is big business. These aren't quaint little European farms. They're every bit as big and every bit as modern and every bit as competitive price-wise as any pig farm in the modern pig factory in the United States. But they make a few little differences and still succeed, still outcompete us. They don't feed their pigs constant diet of antibiotics.
Right.
In fact, the antibiotics are strictly limited. They have to give their pigs a little bit of straw. It sounds silly.
Yeah, I thought it was,
but even a little bit of straw gives the pigs something to do.
Yeah.
And they can't lock their pregnant female pigs in these so-called gestation crates. The females are free to, you know,
yeah,
socialize in groups of a couple of dozen. So it's little changes that make a huge difference.
But you said that it was, you you do have a happy ending in, to a certain extent in this book, because you've found the seeds of change and amelioration of the conditions of large-scale farming.
Well, luckily, and it's been in the last 5 or 10 years, there have been a group of farmers, groups of farmers across the country who have looked at the way pigs are raised and said, we're not going to do it this way. Some do it because they personally don't enjoy farming that way. Others do it for, you know, environmental reasons. But it's a growing number. So now you can get pork that's well raised, which is raised on pasture and not fed a constant diet of antibiotics. The pigs are allowed to roam. They're allowed to express their natural instincts. And they produce really great-tasting meat in the process. And there's also national brands that are now producing raised pork.
So you were ultimately optimistic.
Well, these new people are showing that it can be done. And really all they're doing is sort of going back to the future. Because,
right.
You know, this is the way all pigs were raised until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Allowed to move. And it's a practice that's been forgotten in this constant drive for cheaper and cheaper and cheaper food.
Now, is Niemann or Niemann Ranch one of those people doing it responsibly?
Yeah, Niemann Ranch is probably the best known, and it's a nationally distributed brand.
We met that guy. What's his name?
Paul Willis.
We met him.
Yeah, he's the head of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Niemann Ranch is not a single ranch. It's actually
a cooperative
group, a marketing organization for about 500 small family hog raisers.
But why did Niemann get really upset that his original ideas were distorted by the people who bought his system?
Yes. That was the cattle side of the business that Bill Niemann was referring to. The hog side of the business has for a long time been run by a different man named Paul Willis,
yeah.
And it hasn't changed at all under the new management system. Those pigs are still raised the same way as they were when Bill Niemann was there.
Well, that's very encouraging, because if this wasn't so, this would be a terrible book to read. Amazingly depressing.
Cattle operations, but I spent a lot of time on Niemann pig farms, and the pigs are in the open pasture in the warm weather, running free. In the cold months, especially in the upper Midwest, where a lot of those farms are, they go inside large hoop houses that are filled probably a couple of feet deep with hay,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of hunker down for the winter. The door's open, but the pigs, like to get in where it's a little warmer.
Yeah.
Well, Barry Estabrook, I'm sure you must be working on something else already.
Can you tell us what it is?
And if not, we'll just wait patiently until you finish.
If I did know, you sound like my agent.
There we go.
When are you going to get something else? I'm kicking around a few ideas, but you'll be the first to know when I settle on one.
Right. Well, thank you so much for Americans, and in fact, pork lovers around the world, I guess. You've done them a great service by showing them the seamy underbelly of the business, it sounds like there's light at the end of the tunnel, which is very encouraging. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. The pleasure was mine.
Yeah, Barry, good luck with your book.
Thank you.
I hope it has an enormous impact on all kinds of farming and husbandry, animal husbandry. Take a deserved rest now.
So we hope you'll buy your next pork chop carefully and think about everything that Barry has to say. And in the meantime, we're going to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we have another thinking chef, and I guess we should say the thinking person, consumer, diner chef, is Stephen Satterfield. In his book, Root to Leaf, he traces the seasons, and you trace the seasons with him in delicious dishes, and he's cooking Southern food as well. Listeners, if you think you've seen the most beautiful photographs of vegetables that you've ever seen in your life, you haven't, because they're in this new book by Stephen Satterfield called Root to Leaf, A Southern Chef Cooks Through the Seasons. Congratulations on your book, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Your restaurant is Miller Union in Atlanta.
And that is correct.
Yes, and you were also, as we were talking, you were a finalist for the Best Chef Southeast at the James Beard Awards.
For the third time.
Yes, for the third time. It's starting to get a little nerve-wracking.
Third time's a charm, as they say.
Yeah, maybe so. We'll see.
By the time this airs, he may already have won. How's that?
Well, you shared a lot of yourself in this book, and I thought one of the most interesting things that you did was how candidly you came out and said, I had this cancer thing, and I got over it.
Yes.
It's really remarkable. And you attribute at least some of that to vegetables.
Well, when I was writing the proposal for this book, I was diagnosed, and so I kind of had to put life on hold for a little while. But then it came back. I came back to, once I went through surgery and chemotherapy, and luckily it was only really a six-month process, and I started to heal. I turned to the vegetables that I love so much at our restaurant and from our farmers as a way to heal. And to, I always think about fresh fruits and vegetables are nature's original multivitamin. Most of the things that make up multivitamins come from their earth anyway. And so the more of those things we can eat from the original source, the better our bodies will be. And so it just helped strengthen the theme, some of the themes for the book. And I think it came out a better book as a result.
Well, now your book is organized, of course, by the seasons. And the format, as I see it, is you have spring, summer, fall, and winter. You have an introduction for each vegetable that appears in that season. Then you have the absolutely the most stunning photographs I've ever seen. If I were a radish, I would certainly hire whoever your photographer was. I've never seen such gorgeous radishes in my life. Those watermelon radishes are just divine. But anyhow, and then you have, and along with the photos, and sometimes there are two sets for each vegetable category, then you have your recipes. But it's not a totally vegetarian cookbook. You have, what are some of the you have chicken with radishes, right? And you have other...
Chicken with rhubarb.
And rhubarb, that was it.
Oxtails with rutabagas.
Exactly. So you have the recipes in here as well.
Yeah.
But you
so
say...
I was just going to say, it's just the focus is the produce, and nothing changes throughout the course of the year than what's being harvested by the farmer. And so that's really true seasonal cooking.
And you said, though, that you also, turns out that you have a particular knack for bringing out the best of vegetables. Now, what kind of knack is that, and how do you demonstrate it?
Well, I think that my approach really is just to not tinker with things too much and let this awesome produce really shine by highlighting, like, the best texture that it can be, or not covering it up with too deep of a sauce or whatever, and so really kind of allowing the natural flavors to shine.
You have a checklist here about how to determine, you consider texture,
yeah,
flavor, shape and size, color, and challenges, which I thought was interesting, about, like, is it thick-skinned, hard-shelled? I mean, that's one of the reasons I don't deal with fava beans much.
Fava beans pose a very particular challenge, indeed, where they have to be shucked twice.
Yes.
But the payoff is delicious.
Oh, yes. But people have told me, they've always given me secrets, not a single one of them works. Like, they take the whole branch of the fava beans and stick it in the oven, and then everything's just supposedly slipping right off. Well, it's not true.
Yeah. You know what we do is we we take the pods out of the, we take the peas out of the pod.
Right.
And then we blanch them at that stage, and the inner pea and the hull come apart a lot easier once they've been cooked together.
I see.
From my experience.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's...
Make a little slit with your thumbnail and just squeeze it out.
Okay.
Now, you remember the time when we had those wonderful dried beans?
The gigundas.
The gigantes.
The gigantes.
From Leon Forte.
Leon Forte.
In the center of Sicily. Somebody gave them us a large bag of the dried ones. We brought them home and we kept them in the cupboard, and then we decided finally we'd better cook them. So we looked up instructions as to what to do, and it said boil them first, and then you take the skins off, and then you put them back in again. Dutifully did that. It was a hell of a lot of work. Unfortunately, sadly, when we put them back in again, the beans fell apart.
They totally disintegrated.
So this beautifully shaped, delicious beans. They tasted delicious, but it was like slurry water.
Maybe there was something lost in the translation.
Now, you really have a good handle on history and foundation information about each of these vegetables. You seem to be particularly in love with asparagus.
Asparagus is very special. True seasonal local asparagus is something that's hard to find these days. There's a little joke in there about, I can't remember the exact wording, but fruitful asparagus bed is a reason to renovate rather than move.
Exactly. I read that, yeah.
And I think it's so true. I mean, it's one of the true flavors of spring. And unfortunately, we are in a time where we can kind of get anything we want anytime we want it. And I don't feel that it's right to ship asparagus from the southern hemisphere to America just so we can enjoy it whenever we want to. I think it's better to wait until it's, like, truly in season for us, because it doesn't really travel that well.
Yeah,
and when you have some that's fresh, farm fresh, or even if you can get some that came quickly from the West Coast, it's just that much fresher and that much more flavorful and juicy, and it's got a lot of delicious qualities to it.
Yeah, the French go nuts.
Oh, yeah.
Over the first asparagus of the season. The price is enormous. I can't remember how much we paid.
It was ridiculous.
I think we paid something like $50 for a double portion of the first batch of green asparagus.
It wasn't even white.
Yeah. It wasn't even white.
Well, we just had...
It takes up a lot of real estate on it, in your garden or on a farm.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've tried growing it, and you need... I'm in the city, and you need a whole lot more ground than what I could produce. I'd get maybe two stalks.
It was about the same dimension around as dental floss.
It was not a success. But Bill Fuller just posted a photograph on, he says, happy spring, and he posted a photograph of the first two asparagus spears in his garden sticking up. And they look so, I don't know, they look mystical almost, don't they?
Yeah.
So
they have kind of a dinosaur look to them.
Yeah.
They seem like they've been around for quite some time.
Prehistoric, you're right.
Yes, prehistoric, yes.
Now, you include not only vegetables, but you also do berries, fruits, and nuts, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, you're right on trend here, because we've been interviewing, have you read the Brassicas book?
No, but it sounds like it's right up my alley.
It's fabulous. What's her name?
How am I supposed to remember that? See? Go there and enter Brassicas.
But it's a wonderful book. It made me resolve anew to gobble as much of it as I can. You have on your potato section. I mean, that's one of my favorite vegetables, potatoes.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to learn that they're truly a summer crop.
Yeah, you said that.
Don't realize that, you know, and especially the new potatoes. We're actually seeing those now, as early as now, from Florida and South Georgia. But yeah, they're dug up in the summer, and they're typically cured and dried to last and be shelf stable for quite some time.
Yeah, I was surprised about that. Yeah,
yeah. Even the big Idaho crops, they're all harvested at one time, and then they're cured and dried to be stable and hold on, just in the same way that an onion is or a head of garlic.
Now, the Jersey Royals, they only have, they're from the Jersey in Channel Islands.
Just off the coast of France. in the English mm-hmm. Channel.
And yeah, and they're only their season's really short, like 2 weeks.
I don't, it's
3 weeks.
I mean, I don't know exactly. I mean, we happened to be there last year when the season was beginning, so we had them several meals in a row. Now those we had here, you thought were similar. What were they called? The baby something is
butter babies.
Butter babies.
Butter babies are really good.
They were very similar potato to the Jersey Royal, and very similar to the French one called Marie something or other.
Marie Claire.
And we're seeing all these beautiful heirloom tomatoes now that the local farmers are growing. When you look at the history of potatoes, they have, I think I said tomatoes, but I'm meaning potatoes. They have so many varieties. When you look at the origins, like in South America, there are thousands of varieties of potatoes.
Oh,
and,
yeah, we studied them. We went out to the Potato Research Institute at the University of Lima when we were in Peru. And they have.
I was amazed.
They have something like 10,000 varieties.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And then they have a seed bank of all of those potatoes. I mean, I always thought potatoes grew from a bit of potato, but in fact, they.
Well, what's interesting about how we eat vegetables is it is trendy. Like things that we like, we cultivate and then we hybridize and we make them the way we want them to be. We're altering nature to suit our taste and our needs and our wants. And a lot of varieties get lost in the shuffle with that selection process that we make culturally. So, and you see now that there's this renaissance of farmers market shopping and joining CSA Farm Box subscriptions and going to the green market, that you're seeing more of these varieties start to come back. And one channel we have to thank for is seed companies that have saved these heirloom seed and people that are doing home gardens and farmers that are growing for the public or for restaurants get into those kind of things because it's fun to try something that you've never tried before, like a purple potato or a rose-colored potato or
a red carrot.
Yeah, or golden cauliflower or whatever. There's so much diversity on our earth. We tend to think about an apple as red and potato is white, and there's so much more to it.
Now, you do not include, like, artichokes. You only did things seasonal and local to Atlanta?
That is true. I didn't include artichokes just because they don't grow here, and I was really trying to tell a real story of the ingredients that we work with at the restaurant or that I work with at home. I love artichokes.
Me too.
They're not really part of my story.
Now, you have recipes in this book for preserving, too, pickling.
Yes.
I always read.
They're part of the Southern tradition.
Uh-huh. And, of course, part of the Southern tradition, you have the okra story.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We love okra.
I like it grilled. I don't like most other kinds. And I like it pickled.
But yeah. You never had my fried okra.
Oh, that would be good, too. You know, that would be good, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have a lengthy section on lettuces. I just never thought of them as, I don't know, people, you indicate that people don't really understand lettuce.
I think so. I mean, lettuces, I listed the 7 main varieties, and I found that so fascinating as I was doing my research because, I mean, there are many, many varieties of lettuce, but they fall into 7 categories, and they really are their own kind of subgenus. When people say, like, greens versus lettuces, to me, those are 2 very different things. It's just a semantics, but greens, to me, are things that you're going to cook, and lettuces are not necessarily, although they're delicious grilled. But lettuce, I think, is very interesting, and I'm very fond of making salads, and I have a very specific technique for doing so.
What is that?
Well, the main idea, that foundation of it, is to dress the bowl and not the salad.
Yeah, when I read
so
that.
Whatever you're putting together, and salad is, that word is a huge umbrella that can include so many different things, but if you're making a lettuce-based salad, I find that a lot of times lettuce leaves can be very delicate, and it's really easy to overdress them and make them soggy. And so if you spoon the dressing onto the sides of the bowl and then gently lift the leaves upward in an upward motion and repeat, they just kind of graze the sides and lightly pick up some of the dressing a little at a time, and until it's almost like each leaf is kind of hand-painted.
Yes.
And I think it just makes a better salad, because if you spoon the dressing or pour the dressing over the top of the salad, some of the leaves are going to get saturated, and you just no way around it. So it's hard to get that off once it's on there.
It gets limp and awful, I know.
And it can be limp, yeah. And then overdressed salad is not good. And underdressed salad is not that great either.
Right. See, I have salad every night with no dressing at all.
We have it undressed.
Yeah.
But my mother used to rub the bowl with the garlic. She never put real garlic, whole garlic in anything.
And I think one of the recipes I have, I'm not sure if I included it, but I like to smash the garlic into the vinegar, let it sit, and then remove it so it infuses the vinegar with a light garlic flavor, but it doesn't have that strong, overpowering garlic flavor that gets on your palate and that's hard to get rid of.
Yeah, that's sort of the same idea, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a particular recipe or vegetable that we haven't touched on that you'd like to talk about from your book?
I'm just thinking about that. I have a copy here right in front of me. I'm going to thumb through it. You know, one thing I loved was just doing the research for the information pages. I really think beets is one of the ones that turned out so beautiful. When you think about the winter season, sometimes you might think of it as being kind of drab and dull and gray. And the pictures of the scenery during that time they're beautiful and gray. But then you look at the double page spread of these raw beets. You can see on the twist tie, it says Crystal Organic Farm, which is one of my farmers here in Atlanta. We picked those up right before we drove down to the beach to shoot this chapter. And they're colorful and beautiful and alive. They even have tops because we had a mild December. It's one of the most beautiful chapters to me. All the images of the beets and how brightly colored they are, and they're just delicious. And they're not just red, they're pink and yellow and golden, and there's a lot of different variations.
Yeah, they can even be kind of swirly inside, like the purple
yeah,
potatoes.
They have the little concentric circles that vary in color.
Now, this one's the one that's white, that's a beet?
With the pink circles?
No, it just looks white.
It's the second from the right on the right hand page.
I'm looking. Oh yeah, that is a beet. It's a white beet. Yes.
It's a white beet.
I've never had a white beet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And all of them have those concentric circles. Yeah.
You're lucky to get usually the tops are wrecked by the time you get
right,
them.
Right, right.
Well, I find the same thing with radishes. I just discovered radish greens because I got some fresh radish and it wasn't all limp and wilted.
You should try the radish greens quiche. It's delicious.
Okay.
In the radish chapter. And we're doing a radish greens pea stew right now on our fish dish.
Really?
Oh, that's in the restaurant, great. Yes.
Well, this mm-hmm. was the first time in my life this season that I found fresh-looking greens on them and able to use them, and it was a treat. I love it.
Right. Greeks really love radish tops. They serve them in salads all the time.
Right. Stephen, it's great talking to you, and I hope to see you. And thanks for the tip on trying the radish green.
Absolutely. I enjoyed speaking with both of you.
And we're pulling for you, whether it turns out our good wishes were effective in helping you win James Beard Best Chef Southeast, or whether that didn't happen. Certainly, you have a great entrant here in the world of cooking with your beautiful book, Root.
Thank you so much.
Root to Leaf.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I think this program is coming along rather well. Next up, we have our dear friend, as well as, in my mind, I classify him as one of my favorite philosopher chefs. Here's Trevitt Hooper, who's going to talk to us a little bit about his philosophy of food, which is exemplary, I might tell you, and also about his recent trip to Eastern Europe and Russia.
Why he went and what he found out?
Trevitt Hooper, I remember when I first met you, when your original restaurant, Teeny Tiny Legume in Regent Square.
Uh-huh.
And I had what became your iconic dish, sort of like a brick chicken.
Anyhow,
you've moved on to grander, larger quarters, and you have, in addition to Legume, your restaurant, you have Butter Joint, which has a swell following and a good reputation as a bar with excellent bar food. But you've expanded, but you really haven't changed your attitude about the kinds of food that you want to serve, have you?
No, and really part of the reason for the expansion itself really was to execute our vision better. One thing about being such a small restaurant, being a 34-seater, was we couldn't do things like get, like, the whole animal and do that whole thing. And we were just really limited by the relationships we form with farms. For example, the people we're getting produce from now, mainly Who Cooks For You Farm, and we get so much produce from them that they're able to adjust. It makes sense for them to adjust their operations to accommodate us, and so that it's a really nice partnership. Being a 34-seater, 5 pounds here, 10 pounds there, it's hard to really form that kind of relationship when the scale is so small.
Now, that's key to your, I'm going to use the word philosophy, but don't take that literally. You, as a former philosophy major, you might take it too literally. I just want you to explain to our listeners who have not experienced your menus and food at Legume your concept of what kind of food you want to serve and how you have these relationships with local relationships with farmers.
Well, I think the simple answer to that is I really want to make food that is, as much as possible, just not from an industrialized farm. And that is not necessarily as easy as just saying, tomorrow I'm just going to cook everything organically. It's really a mix of things. It's really a slow building of a network of people that can supply you with that kind of food. So
you found this when you thought that you were going to use only local grass-fed beef, and everybody wanted the same piece of steak, right?
Right, and that's part of the reason for Butter Joint, the bar next door, is we realized everybody wants rib steaks. Everybody wants tenderloins, and so we have an outlet for a lot of ground beef. with the hamburgers and the kielbasa, which are really popular over there. So really it's a holistic operation that we're really constantly recalibrating and constantly rethinking. And there's always some kind of a tweak that needs to be made.
Well, now, you have a really fairly founding team put together in your kitchen at Legume and in Butter Joint. You've become involved with the do-yourself movement pretty well, doing all that fermentation. You're sort of the expert on fermentation in this area, aren't you?
I certainly don't feel like an expert, but really that came about in a really natural way, the fermentation. We started making sauerkraut first fall that we were open, and that was back in 2007, and then I didn't think of it as fermentation. I just thought of it as making sauerkraut. And then one day, a couple years later, we got our Chris from Who Cooks For You Farm had a ton of bok choy he was trying to get rid of, so he showed up in the back door with a bunch of bok choy and a copy of Sandor Katz's kimchi recipe. So we made his kimchi recipe with bok choy. But we didn't really think of it as fermentation as a thing. Meanwhile, during all this time, we were doing all kinds of canning and pickling, in not fermented pickles, but just like pickles in jars. And that was something that we were already doing. And then eventually I got Sandor Katz's book, and I was thinking, fermentation, a lot of things started to come together. Like, if we learn how to do all of our pickles this way, instead of doing them in jars, we're going to be able to really do a lot, make a lot more pickles and have a lot more food in the winter that is from kinds of farms that we want to be sourcing from. So I would say every year we do more and more, and so we're at a point now where
these fermented things are really becoming staples on the menu. For example, right now, actually this is the last week for it, because we have nice spring nettles, but we do like a sauerkraut soup that we make all winter long.
I just had it for lunch there. I love it, yes.
Thanks. And that is a traditional Russian soup, it's a sauerkraut soup, basically. And so we also take that same exact recipe. Instead of using sauerkraut, we use the bok choy kimchi that we've made. So it's kind of like that was not something we never thought we're going to make a bok choy kimchi soup. It was just like, 3 years ago, we made 700 pounds of bok choy kimchi, and we're like, what the heck are we going to do with it? We still have it in March, and it looks like we're going to have it for a long time. So we made it into a soup. And so that's really kind of how our cooking at Lagoom is. It's very process-driven, and it begins with a desire to source food year-round from the kinds of farms that we want to be that do things in a healthy way that are sustainable for, I mean, I don't like to use the word sustainable and local because they're just such hackneyed terms
tells people where you're coming from. I mean, this is...
It does, but I think a lot of people who, times, it's a marketing device.
Yeah, but you're serious about it. In fact, you're one of the most serious chef owners that I know in Pittsburgh. You're really serious about it. And this leads us to, we just interviewed someone who was described by Time Magazine as the conscience of the food movement. And he probably is. I mean, he's a really brilliant guy. But anyhow, from our little world here, I think you could also qualify as a conscience of food or the food movement, because you do a function that way. It has to be right.
That's very nice. Thank you. And, you know, I think I also feel privileged to be able, that I've found a niche of people who appreciate it. I think most chefs really do want to cook this way. They really do want to cook with these ingredients. They don't always have a market to cook for that appreciate it. Value it, I think, is a better way to put it. And so I feel very fortunate in Pittsburgh that we've had a following who lets me cook like this and lets me pursue these kind of crazy ideas.
Sometimes you're a little bit crazy, I must say.
Well, you know, Tony Pius, I saw this great quote. He said, to be in the business, you have to be crazy or you have to love it. And if you're both, then maybe you're good.
That's good.
Something like that. And, I mean, it is, the whole thing is just insane.
Well, now, this brings us to one of the factors that resulted in this interview. It precipitated the interview, I guess I should say. And that is your grand trip to Eastern Europe and Russia.
Yes.
Could you explain to our, I mean, I know the reason, but could you explain to our listeners what the mission of this trip was?
Sure. Well, so in the summer, it's easy to know what we want to cook. Every few weeks, there's new things to cook with, new vegetables, salmon's in season, like halibut's in season. Like, it's just a nice time to be cooking from about June until November. And even December and January aren't that bad either, because you're not sick of root vegetables yet. But like February, March, April, early May in Pittsburgh is a really not pleasant time to cook, and it's hard to really be inspired. So my idea, I think 2 years ago, I went to Chicago, and for the very reason of like, gee, there's a lot of good restaurants here, a lot of people, like, you know, sourcing from their local farmers, like, what, Chicago is probably a really good place to go look and for some inspiration, and it was. There were just really generous chefs let me into their kitchen, and I met a lot of great guys, and I was really impressed. Like, they have some really wonderful, somebody's growing just the most amazing lettuce ever. I had this amazing lettuce salad at Blackbird, and I this really great pork that at a couple different places were it was like a local pork producer, and they're a big enough operation where, you know, if you want pork chops, you can get pork chops from this farm. Here, it's like, if you want to get local pork chops from, like, a pig that, you know, had a good diet and was healthy and all that, you're going to have to take the whole pig, and you're going to get 20 pork chops out of it, and then you have the rest of the pig to deal with. Chicago has this great infrastructure, an infrastructure that is made that's much better developed for eating locally year-round than what we have in Pittsburgh. So, not thinking that this is going to happen overnight in Pittsburgh, I thought, well, what are parts of the world that have a cooking traditions that developed before refrigeration? And so that would obviously, and that look like ours. Obviously everywhere has a, every culture developed the cuisine before refrigeration, but what are parts of the world that look very similar to Pittsburgh that have very similar climates and just have us things that are, like the things that grow here, like thing, when we go to the market in Pittsburgh, what's available here, it all looks very similar to Eastern Europe. And so, and plus just the cultural terroir of Pittsburgh, the people who built the city they're the immigrant populations of the late 1900s, like very strong influence is felt here from, you know, Poland and especially in Eastern Europe. So that's what prompted me to go to these places. Kind of a long-winded answer.
Yeah, well, you sent me an email, and you had very specific ideas, such as you were going to go to Hungary to see the Mengelist, well, it's spelled different and pronounced different by everybody, the pork, you know, that's the curly pig, right?
Yes.
Visit two paprika museums, visit Big Food Market in Budapest, visit Tokaj, eat at a fancy restaurant. In Poland, visit sausage maker, visit cheese maker, visit mead maker, which, by the way, is going to be the next popular alternative to wine.
Should be. It's great.
Yeah. And hunt down and try my favorite Pittsburgh Polish foods and eat them in their native tongue and learn how to make pierogies. In Russia, participate in Maslen, the pancake week.
Yep.
The pre-Lenten thing. Hang out in a Russian village, a hotel with a restaurant in Vladimir known for its food cooked in traditional Russian ovens, eat bear meat, get drunk on vodka in fancy Moscow hotel, hunt down and meet Maxim Sermakov, visit the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, visit Lenin's mausoleum. Did you do all that?
I did probably about 70% of those things. We had a very ambitious itinerary. And say in Poland, in Hungary, we were fortunate enough to just have some great connections and a very generous lady who heads up the slow foods chapter in Tokaj. And she just planned the most wonderful week for us. And every day was just really, really full of amazing experiences, and by the time we got to Poland, we just kind of needed a breather, and we also didn't have as much, we were only there for 4 days, and we didn't have quite as much lined up anyways, but we had a great time there, so I didn't get to make pierogies, learn how they do it there, but I ate their pierogies, and I think really we have pretty comparable pierogies here in Pittsburgh, but really I wanted to. Yeah, I ate a lot of the Zurich soup.
You have that on your menu, huh?
Yes, that was the one dish on the whole trip that I just needed to make when I got back here.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love it. Absolutely love it. Now,
thank you.
This is a terrible question to ask, but can you condense your experiences into give me the top three things that were takeaways from this trip?
Well, I think most of what I take away, I think, is just kind of very general, like an appreciation just for old things. You know, our culture, you really have a sense of how young American culture is over there.
Oh, yeah.
And when we were hanging out with, like, Russians, like, you get the sense that, like, for example, that the Tartar invasion isn't, that's still something they think about. And we barely even think about, like, Revolutionary War. Like, right. So their sense of history, the sense of time and culture is very different there. But as far as, like, kind of food experiences that I could really pinpoint, I would say so we did this, we were at this farm in Hungary, and we went in the morning and we killed a pig. Well, we didn't. They killed a pig. And then we watched it being,
yeah, that's a
know,
big deal, I know. That's a big deal in Eastern Europe, that whole festival of pig killing.
Yeah, yes. And it was so amazing to see the, so this experience, you know, these farmers, they killed the pig, they burned all the hair off, they cleaned it, they eviscerated it, they used every bit of it, and they, the rest of the day they made sausage from it. They did like a blood sausage, they did like a blood pudding kind of thing that we had for breakfast, and they butchered it, and they did all kinds of things to it. And what really struck me about it was the wide range of the skill set that they had. Here in kind of the United States, you know, we're very we take a very industrialized, specialized approach to everything. So, like, there's the slaughterhouse where they, you have the guys who kill the pigs,
and then you have the guys who
goes down like an assembly line, and people get really good at, like, one or two aspects of it. And then the butchers do what they do, and then it gets down to the chefs. And so it's like this long string of, like, really highly, highly specialized knowledge. And here, it was a much more generalized knowledge. And the skill sets that they had were so broad. It was just so interesting to me how they knew how to do so many things.
Well, it's ingrained in them, and it's a tradition that's kept alive. You were to be doing research for a dasha. That's your restaurant. A dasha is a sort of a holiday home away from the cities, traditionally. In Russia. And I guess you're planning on that, but it's going to be a while down the line, you said.
Well, yes, and I think for dasha, dasha is about, I am going to do it eventually, and the way I was kind of thinking about it today is, so, you know, Lagoon is very much driven by principles and ideas, and I was thinking about how Lagoon is, if Lagoon was a car, it would be a Prius, right? we source as well as we can, and hopefully in other ways we do a really good job, but at the end of the day, we're still a car. We still have an impact. We're still part of something that I don't think is really necessarily a great thing. Whereas I would say dasha, I want it to be more like a bicycle. I want it to really be, there's a lot about restaurant cooking and just restaurants in general that are just not sustainable. I mean, you can't have a sustainable version of something that's inherently unsustainable. We can't just have sustainable meat. We need to change the way we eat meat. And we need to change the way we do a lot of things. And those are the kind of things that I think dasha is going to explore. And hopefully, we'll explore these ideas, we'll get really good at them, and then they'll kind of find their way back to Lagoon.
It sounds so exciting. You sound a little bit like Dan Barber, and you're thinking of a sort of, it's revolutionary, but in a nice, quiet, sustainable way.
Well, anything that is truly revolutionary has to find its way in the real world, and it's gradual and slow, and it just takes time.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and until it gets closer, I'll just be looking forward to my next meal at Lagoon.
Oh, thank you. We love cooking for you.
Oh, Trevor, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us in your hectic schedule.
Thank you. I love to talk about myself.
Okay, Trevor, and hello to your wonderful staff.
Thank you, I will.
And that's a wrap for this week. I hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.